you can feed that part of you that wants to be mad at the success of mediocrity, and then you'll become a bitter, sad person. Or you can cultivate a habit of loving great work.
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like, garbage in, garbage out, or you are what you think, ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for joining us. Our guest today is Dan Wilson, a Grammy Award-winning singer, songwriter, musician, producer, and visual artist. He's known as the leader of the band Semisonic, for which he wrote the Grammy-nominated Closing Time. Wilson has also released several solo recordings, including the 2014 release Love Without Fear. He was also a member of the Minneapolis psychedelic rock band Trip Shakespeare. Here's the interview.
Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
As I was just saying to you a little bit before we got started, I'm very excited to have you on. I have been a fan of your music since I was probably 18 years old, and there is just something about your voice when you're singing that every time I hear it, it just immediately makes me feel better. So that's a great thing, and so thank you for that.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Really appreciate hearing that.
So our podcast is called The One You Feed, and it's based on the parable of two wolves, where there's a grandfather who's talking with his grandson, and he says, in life there are two wolves inside of us that are always at battle. One is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness and bravery and love, and the other is a bad wolf, which represents things like greed and hatred and fear. And the grandson stops and he thinks about it for a second, and he looks up at his grandfather and he says, well, grandfather, which one wins? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. So I'd like to start off by asking you how that parable applies to you in your life and in the work that you do.
Well, I think the first thing that strikes me about the parable is that the grandfather doesn't commit to like a permanent victory of one wolf or the other. And the way he talks about it, it's like that the both wolves are always available for the feeding. And I kind of like that about the parable. I definitely have a similar philosophy, although I guess wolves haven't entered into it. But I feel like whenever I have pictured something happening in the future, so often that thing has actually happened, or something really close to that thing. Yeah, I've been very lucky in my choice of things to picture, I guess, because it seems really very consistent that whatever we put our energy or our imagination into, it eventually becomes reality. So I guess that's how I see the wolf parable, is that it's the idea of which wolf winning is almost like which wolf gets to turn into, you know, gets to be real, which wolf gets to be turned into reality.
Right. I like that. And you talk about sort of your thinking about what the wolf that wins is the one that gets your thoughts and your attention. And one of the things I like about you're a visual artist as well as a musician. And you've also started doing something on Vine's 6-second songwriting lessons. And one of the things that I've picked up from some of those and also from some of the pictures that you've drawn is this idea of just showing up and doing the work towards the things that you care about consistently. And I think that that plays into that theme also.
Yes. One thing that needs to be nurtured and fed is whatever your gift is, whatever is the thing that you want to share with the world, and whatever is the gift that you want to give to the world, you actually have to feed that. You have to actually have to nurture it and feed it. You can't, it doesn't, giving it doesn't make it go away. And it's ignoring it is what makes it go away. Giving it makes it stronger and more powerful. Hoarding it and saving it and not doing something with it makes it wither.
There was something I saw of yours very recently, and I'm not going to get it right because I don't have it right in front of me, but you talked about having a good plan and doing something is better than waiting on a great plan.
Yeah. Well, I've always been, in songwriting, I always feel like it's hard to tell. I mean, maybe some people are really geniuses at this, but it's hard for me to tell which idea is, amazing and which one is really, really good. I can tell when they're bad, but even then I can't tell. But a lot of times I think I have started out a song with what seemed to be a pretty good idea, and then somewhere along the line, at some point, something happened, some little turning point, or some other idea kind of sprang out, and then what seemed to be pretty good actually is incredible and great, and a gift, And so I'm not a believer in assessing early whether an idea is, of a high enough quality to continue. I kind of feel like if I'm going to do some songwriting right now, then I'm just going to try to figure out what's my favorite idea right now that I actually have and work on that, or have a new idea and work on that. I think you can wait for a good pitch to excess. I think sometimes you got to swing at a few pretty good outside the strike zone pitches.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I think that applies really to anything in life. It's so easy for, certainly for times for me in life to think that certain conditions need to line up in order for me to do this thing that I want to do or that thing versus right. Just doing something always seems to lead to obviously better results. And things tend to emerge as, at least for me, things tend to emerge as soon as I get engaged in the process.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's funny because I don't like to argue with my fellow songwriters about how to do it. So I almost feel like everybody's got their right to pick their times. I have a good friend who's a really, really talented musician, and he is very much of the philosophy that you wait until everything is perfect, and then you strike creatively. You wait until the day is right, and you wait until the idea is good enough, and you wait until the mood strikes. And, I get that. I understand why that's a good thing for him. But I've gotten so many good results from just charging ahead with an idea that seemed good enough. And then later you find that there was something really, really magical in there.
Are there any of your songs that you think that might apply to the parable at all?
No, that's an interesting question.
The one that I thought of was Free Life to some degree, because it's about making it, it's about making choices. At least that's what it means to me.
The vibe that I get from Free Life is that we are kind of works in progress, that we are always creating ourselves together and individually, and that there's a kind of beautiful but scary open-endedness about every moment in life and about even like identity, who one is at all. There's an open-endedness in that as well. I feel like that song is almost a reminder of how unformed or how fresh and formable, I guess, how malleable and fresh and
and workable our lives can be if we just think of them that way.
In the air the questions hang, will we get to do something? Who we gonna end up being? How we gonna end up feeling? What you gonna spend?
The new album is called Love Without Fear, and the title track is called Love Without Fear. And I think I heard you say that you had written that about a friend.
Yeah.
Can you maybe share more about that?
I was probably partway through writing songs for the album, and when I'm writing a lot of songs, I get into this mode where everything that happens turns into a song in my mind. And I had this uncomfortable conversation with a friend of mine on the phone. I think he and I were planning, or we were not exactly planning something, but we were sort of comparing notes about what we were going to do in the coming year. And it got really uncomfortable and really kind of negative, and I couldn't figure out why. And after we got off the phone, it went downhill and it got really bad. But at the end of the conversation, I felt like, wow, we just had almost like a big fight, and I don't exactly know what it's about. And when I thought about it for a little while, I realized that my friend was worried that I was going to do a series of dumb things that were going to hurt him in specific ways. It took me a minute to figure out what those things were and how to convince him that that those things weren't going to happen, that wasn't part of my plan. But he was definitely, afraid that I was going to kind of trample his agenda in some way. And once I realized that, it was a huge relief. For a while, I was sort of mad at him for being sort of difficult, or, mad at him for being afraid or sad or whatever it was. And once I realized that I had it within my power to reassure him, it was like his sort of weight was lifted. And I would like to say that I called him right away to talk to him about it, but actually I wrote a song first.
Well, I'm glad you did. I love the melody on that.
Thank you.
All I want in this life of mine, someone to take my hand, walk with me side by side. In this world of tears, someone to give me time, and love without fear, give me time, and love without fear.
So Trip Shakespeare was the, at least I wouldn't say it was your first band, but it was the first band that you were probably known for. And yeah. I just love that old music. It's just,
cool.
It's amazing. Is there any music from that time that really sticks with you today that you feel like you're particularly proud of? I mean, it's a great body of work, but I'm kind of curious what stands out for you.
Of the Trip Shakespeare music, I have been listening to it a bit more lately because John Munson from the band has been spearheading a re-release project of the albums. And so we've listened to a lot of the songs on the records and also a lot of B-sides and unreleased things. And the stuff that really strikes me almost is the stuff is the live bootleg recordings where the band jammed and improvised. Because I think that was one of our great superpowers, and that's one of the reasons people really loved the live shows. And I think we never did figure out how to get that to happen on records.
We played a couple gigs, and we're well received, but the tool master lost his verve. Don't ask me why. For some reason he lost his... Yes, thank you. That... You got something to tell me, Dan? A letter came from the Buckeye Creamery. It said,
Mr. Master Upgrader, we're gonna start up the oil machinery.
Girlfriends line up in the sky and tell them to kiss the Twin Towns goodbye. He rumbled north for a change of scenery. Goodbye. Tool master of
So when I listen to the records, I sometimes feel like, okay, these are really good, like, you know, sort of rock songwriting songs. And yet I think that the thing that the band did best was often hidden and not part of the records. So I like listening to the live bootlegs.
Is any of that going to be part of the re-releases?
I think it is. I think there are going to be some, it's interesting because I feel like I think maybe it's either going to be that some live versions are going to make it onto the re-releases or that we're going to just do a separate project entirely involving live stuff, which either one would be great.
It would be great. You guys were so fun to watch live.
We had just sort of developed, over time, we developed a very intuitive way of relating to each other where we really knew where things were going without having to acknowledge it on stage at all. We just kind of knew, oh, we're heading into this weird zone. And we would really all kind of flock from sound to sound or idea to idea. And it was very, it's funny because I think Trip Shakespeare was just ahead of the jam band idea, you know, a circuit of touring that was designed, you know, that got designed around the jam bands all happened just a bit after Trip Shakespeare. So, you know, I think a lot of, you know, groups that admired us and watched our concerts like Phish, you know, just, they got started just a little bit later and a kind of a scene and a way of presenting that music kind of coalesced around them, and we were just a little bit on the early end.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here,
and with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Yeah, the thing I loved about so much of that music was there was that free-flowing element to it, and yet the songwriting, at least in my perspective, was so good in comparison to a lot of what I would consider jam band songwriting.
Yeah.
Just so... How did you guys write songs? Because you had... across the different songs, there were three of you that would take lead vocals, right? Your brother or John. How did you guys write songs, and how did you decide who would sing what? Was there any sort of process to that?
It was kind of... well, how did the songs get written? It was mostly Matt who would initiate them. My role in the songwriting was quite often just to finish something. Like... you know, a song would be three quarters done, but it needed a bridge, and so I would write a bridge. Or Matt might have a completed lyric, but he just didn't have a melody for it, and he would give it to me, and I would write a melody for it. And, you know, for example, there was a song called Spirit that was on the second album, and Spirit was a poem that Matt gave me, and I wrote a piece of music to it, and I sang it for the band. And John said, "Can I sing that one?" And I think that John sort of would like lay in wait for a really good song and say, "Hey, can I sing that one?" And so I think he often sang some really good songs, partly because he was sort of patiently waiting for a really good one to come along.
Well, I doubt he had to wait too long.
You know, it's funny because I do feel like the songwriting kind of the pure songwriting side of Trip Shakespeare was definitely very quirky, but very, very strong in its own way.
Hear me tell how you walk in dreamland with a line from the back of your head to the reel that revolves at the center, and you wait for the yank of the hook. When the dogs of the bank are upon me now, and they've come to repossess my car, I'll be found at the base of the canyon. I'll be torn from the wreck of the motor.
I think it almost would have been great for the band if we had just, if the rule was that you could do different versions of the same song on different albums, because our versions live of a particular song would be so wildly different from month to month. And it almost was like a new work of art. But there was this kind of like pop songwriting, unwritten rule that you know once you recorded a song on an album, you couldn't put it on another album. And it strikes me now, like thinking back, like, wow, it would have been kind of awesome if we could have had a few songs that appeared again and again on records, and you know, if that could have been sort of part of our playbook, it might have been interesting, because our transformations of the songs were really pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit like Dylan. You can hear all that stuff got released later as part of that, but you can hear multiple versions of one song. It's just really interesting to hear them so drastically reinterpreted or arranged.
Yeah, there was a concert around the heat of Trip Shakespeare time. I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was Elvis Costello in Minneapolis at the Northrop Auditorium, and he had a horn section. It was him and the Attractions and a horn section. And they just they did horn heavy versions of all of Elvis Costello's songs, and completely different from the album versions of the songs. Like, so different. A fast song would be slow and a slow song would be fast, and there's blasting horns on everything. And it was just, to me, it was very disorienting, but kind of amazing. It made me realize that the song itself is like a free floating idea that doesn't necessarily have to be tied to one interpretation. And that was a really huge learning moment for me.
Yeah. So after Trip Shakespeare, you went on and formed a band, Semisonic, that you had a big hit with, Closing Time. There was a song on your first record that was a huge fan of and still am. I was going through a really bad breakup at the time, and it was Brand New Baby.
Mm.
And what is so great about that song is that it is such a sad subject, but there is just the joy that comes out of the way it's produced and sung. I just, so many times, that was such a great song to just make me feel better.
Time, you needed time, out of the mainstream. Out on your own, alone to find yourself somehow. So I'm a bit surprised to see.
That's nice to hear. I like that a lot. I mean, all of the songs that I write, if they're angry or bitter or sad or troubled, it's because I'm angry or bitter or sad or troubled at the time, you know? So everything I write comes out of some real experience. But it's actually, for me, kind of comforting to turn it into something beautiful or something rousing. You know, I think Brand New Baby is a really rousing song, and it's really fun to play live. It's got a lot of chords. It's kind of hard to play live, but it's really fun to play live because it's just like, it's almost like shaking off your troubles just by being really loud about them, you know?
Right, exactly. It is. It's a great one. So after that, you've kind of gone on and released a couple solo records. And the other thing that you've had a lot of success with is you have co-written some really big hits for Adele and the Dixie Chicks, and have had a lot of success in that area.
That's been an interesting and kind of unexpected joy for me. I always wanted to co-write songs and put them on other people's albums, or at least I knew that was a thing when I was a kid. And then in the late 90s, I really worked to try to make it happen. And I guess it took me like maybe 4 or 5 years to figure out how to do it well.
It seems like you certainly got the hang of it. A question that I have for you is, one of the ways that my bad wolf tends to manifest itself is in comparison, and I wonder, is it ever challenging for you that some of the songs you've written, co-written, go on to get huge, and your own solo work is comparatively obscure in that? How do you, because there's obviously, it's great that that's happening for you. Do you ever wrestle with that?
Yeah, I do. It's funny. I there's a joke that a friend of mine told me years ago. A man gets two ties from his mother for his birthday, a red tie and a blue tie. And the next time he sees his mother for lunch, he wears the red tie. And they sit down to lunch, and she looks down at his tie, and she looks back up at him and says, what's the matter? You didn't like the other tie? And to me, it's a very like similar thing. Like if I write two songs and one of them becomes a hit, an unavoidable little knee-jerk reaction that I have is, what's wrong with the other song? You didn't like that other song, everybody? What's wrong with you? I can't help it. I want them all to be sort of equally loved, even though it doesn't, in the case of the tie story, like you can't wear two ties at once. But in my case, like, you know, so if I do a solo album and then write a song that's, you know, gets on the radio and someone else is singing it, it's both of them are my work. But, you know, I kind of want people to like everything that I do. So I want them to hear my solo records and my co-writes and my productions and everything else.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right. I think that's one of those sort of what wolf do you feed? It's easy to twist that into, I mean, I know people who would certainly look at that and just feel grouchy about it. And the other interpretation about it is it's amazing the things that you're doing and that people are hearing them and to have those opportunities. And it's sort of what perspective do you want to take on it?
Yeah. And there's kind of a, it's hard to explain exactly, but I was talking with a friend about a project that they were working on that is charitable. And this charitable project is a very specific thing that's only going to benefit a few specific people. It's best that it works that way. But my friend feels a lot of pressure from the world to have whatever idea that they're working on be scalable. You need to be able to scale it up. You know, what's the matter? You can't help 100,000 people with this idea. You're only helping 4 people with this idea. You know, you got to be able to scale it up to 1 million people or 4 million people or whatever. And you know, I think artists struggle with that a lot, especially pop artists, where scaling your work up to massive numbers is a you know, it's a long-standing hope that a lot of people have. You write a song, it's great to have it be very meaningful for a handful of people, but it's also awesome to have it be meaningful to, you know, millions of people. The thing is, like, for me, like, if I think about whom I am envious of in the world of music, it's really funny. It's a strange thing because I'm not very envious usually. I'm actually pretty much on my own path, and I kind of understand that I have a weird and quirky kind of unique path in music, and I'm very lucky, you know, no one else gets to be me. But if I'm ever envious, the strange pattern is that I'm envious of people, musicians or creators of music, for their success only if I despise their music. I'm never envious of someone whose music I love and who is successful.
Yep. I read a study recently or some research about that seems to be exactly, because I've been really interested in when does, because it's, we all compare ourselves to others, right? It's just part of what happens, and it would be nice if it didn't happen, but it does. And but there seem to be cases where that comparison is kind of benign or even can be motivating. And then there's other cases where it's not so much. And it's really interesting that the research seems to say that when, if you compare yourself to somebody who you, A, you like, or B, you see like you could become what they're being, or then you it tends to be pretty benign. But if you compare yourself to people who don't seem anything like you, or seem to have gotten some break that you never got, or seem to, you know, there's something about their circumstance that makes them able to do it, then that tends to become more of, you know, a maladapted. And I just thought that was really interesting. That sort of fits exactly with what you're saying there.
My theory about this whole question of like envy and comparison for myself is that when I contemplate or think about or kind of dream about the successes of people that I, whose music I love, my biggest kind of emotion is gratitude. Like, I'm so happy that I've gotten the chance to hear their music.
Right.
And somehow that kind of neutralizes, you know, what you could imagine would be the possibility of feeling envy. And so that's why, strangely, my only little twinges of envy here and there are, like, I sometimes envy people who I think are, you know, create mediocre music and are very successful.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, why? I don't even want that life. I don't even want to be like that at all. But I think it's almost like I envy them in the way that a person might envy someone who wins the lottery by chance, you know, and so.
Exactly.
You know, but it's, you know, one of my lucky breaks in life is that's a very small kind of component of my psyche. And, you know, years ago, I had this really interesting experience. I went to a question and answer by Frank Stella, who's a painter from New York that I admire a lot. And he gave a talk, and then afterwards we were allowed to ask questions. And I said to him, and I was probably 21, I said to him, you know, I go to the museums and I look at the paintings, and there's so many bad paintings. There's so much bad work, and it's, you know, up on the walls of the museum, and it's getting rewarded, and it's succeeding, and yet I, Dan, know that it's bad. You know, what do you think about that, Mr. Stella? And he said, worrying about bad art succeeding is not your job. It's of no concern. Your job is to find the art that inspires you and that fires your imagination. And your job is to study that art and figure out how they did it. Forget about the bad stuff. Your job is to look for great stuff that you love. And I was so struck by that. It was very simple. Like, oh, I get to just ignore the things that I don't think are good and just pay super close attention to the things that I think are great. And that's really, that helped me so much over the years. That one bit of advice has been super helpful for me.
Yeah, it's really about putting the focus on sort of the process and the internal piece and the internally versus the external reward of it.
Or it's like this. You can feed that part of you that wants to be mad at the success of mediocrity, and then you'll become a bitter, sad person. Or you can cultivate a habit of loving great work and feeling grateful for it and being excited about it and sharing it with your friends and thinking, I want to do something this great. And then that's the part of you that'll grow, and that becomes your character over time. And I really feel like Frank Stella was at the right place at the right time in my life to say that thing that was so helpful.
That's great. Well, I think that brings us to a pretty good point to wrap up.
Cool.
Dan, thanks so much for being on the show. I really enjoyed talking with you. And it's, like I said, your music has meant so much to me. So speaking of appreciating great art, thank you.
Cool, man. Thanks for having this conversation with me. I hope that what I said makes sense.
Yeah, I think it was great. All right, take care.
Cool, man.
Bye.
Bye.
You can learn more about Dan Wilson and this podcast at oneufeed.net/Wilson.